Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman with Jurinov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, an electronic discovery show which purpose is to make concepts in electronic discovery accessible to everyone for a price that everyone can afford free, but also at a time without having to be at a certain place or travel to listen to speakers who talk all over the country in many cases. And today's guest is no exception. I'm thrilled that we have Craig Ball on today's show for a number of reasons. Craig is a prolific contributor to continuing legal and professional education programs throughout the United States. He's delivered in excess of 500 presentations and papers. His articles on forensic technology and electronic discovery frequently appear in the national media. I was at a national conference in D.C. and listened to Craig be interviewed by the Wall Street Journal, in the middle of during a break. But he's been in American Bar Association publications, ATLA, American Lawyer Media, print and online publications. He also writes a monthly column on computer forensics and e-discovery for Law Technology News called Ball in Your Court. By the way, Law Technology News is a free publication that I encourage, everyone to subscribe to. It's still free, right, Craig?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And Craig was honored as the 2007-2008 Gold Medal honorees, the best regular column as awarded by the Trade Association Business Publications International. Many, many other awards. And, a couple funny things. Craig, I like to prepare for these shows by reading articles, and I gave up with you. I mean, I've got a stack in front of me.
I didn't know they were that bad.
No, there's a lot of information to cover. And the last thing I wanted to mention is that, here at ESI Bytes, we're trying very hard to be agnostic. And Craig Ball, among many things, is a forensic expert nationally, just like a service that Jurinov provides. But when Tim Opsitnik and I were putting a list of good speakers together and knowledgeable, we both wanted you on the show. So let's.
Thanks, Carl, and I'm hoping to move you right over into atheist.
Well, a lot of people like to know, when they hear someone like yourself talk, how did you get involved in the field of electronic discovery?
Oh, goodness gracious! Well, I've been involved with computers really since I built my first electronic slide rule in the fifth grade. So I was a nerd back. I pretty much it was clear that I was never going to, get a girlfriend the way I was behaving. I learned basic programming in high school using a time-shared mainframe, and I was well on my way to fulfilling my then dream of becoming an electrical engineer and an inventor. But I got sidetracked into the law. And even as a lawyer, I was an early adopter of PCs back in the TRS-80, or what's called Trash 80 days of the very first personal computers. Then I moved into IBMs and Compacts and clones and bulletin boards and the Internet and web development for bar associations, teaching technology to lawyers, and my hobby was data recovery and forensics. So you can see I never completely outgrew the terminal nerdiness. Judges then started appointing me as what would today be called a special master. This goes back some years. And I started writing and publishing and lecturing and doing some of the things you were kind enough to mention. And from there, I've just kind of ridden the tide.
Well, that's great. We actually did a real nice show on special masters last week with Jonathan Redgrave, which it's an interesting field in and of itself. Now, looking at the field of electronic discovery just generally, and then we're going to talk about the field of forensics, which is what we'll focus most of the show on. Where do you see the field of electronic discovery going?
Well, I think in terms of penetration into cases, sheer numbers of cases where electronic discovery will be an object of early concern and will be consuming a lot of lawyers' time and attention, I see a very substantial growth, notwithstanding an overall contraction of the legal industry. But I want to be clear about that. I think we will see a dollar contraction in some ways on electronic discovery, and that's a very good thing. Right now, electronic discovery costs too much. It is simply kind of whatever the market will bear in terms of pricing. Pricing is rather disingenuously tied to volumes before appropriate filtering and search. And so I think we're going to see overall dollars kind of stagnate or maybe even go down a bit in the coming year, but for most of us in the practice, e-discovery is going to be growing in our consciousness and growing in our day-to-day activities. So, I look at it this way. The volume and the variety of revealing electronic evidence is growing at a continuing explosive level. I mean, if you remember the old quip of the infamous safecracker Willie Sutton, he was asked why he robbed banks, and he said, well, that's where the money is. And we're going to turn more and more to ESI because, like it or not, that is where the evidence is.
Okay. Is the field getting better over the last couple of years? Because this is still a pretty new field.
Oh, I think unquestionably the field is getting better. If you define better, as I do, with people developing better skills, making fewer stupid mistakes, starting earlier to address the problem. We've seen a tremendous growth in the number of cases that expose flaws. Lawyers who don't act honestly where e-discovery is concerned or competently, destruction of evidence. I mean, that's going on more and more because electronic evidence is being focused on more and more. But I'm encouraged. I think the overall tide of understanding is rising, albeit much more slowly than I'd hoped.
You know, I had one general question posted here on the show, which is a live show, and the listener said, are you concerned about the abuse of electronic discovery from one side to the other? And Ralph Losey and Judge Shindlin talked about this in our podcast. Do you have any thoughts at all about that as a concern?
I do, and I think that the notion that electronic discovery is being used as a very blunt instrument to extort settlements is overblown and largely unfounded. I think you can't extort something from someone unless they're exposed, and the only way you get terribly exposed on electronic discovery is being not ready or poorly managing your information. Because there are a lot of tools and avenues for the producing parties to cut back on electronic discovery, to learn how to reduce the volume, to learn how to cut the cost of review, which is where most of the money is spent and I would say wasted, to get better handles on your proliferation of privileged information, and to persuade the court through education of where it makes sense to rein in out-of-line discovery requests. So the fact of the matter is, I believe requesting parties haven't begun to fight. In point of fact, the producing parties have had it so good for so long, they've been getting away with murder for so long, that all this screaming is coming about because people didn't get ready the way they should have. I am not sympathetic to that whole argument.
And your answer was wonderful. You just threw out four possible topics of future shows. So, but anyway, a lot of the people, and the beauty of what I think one of the beauties of this show is that people in jurisdictions and at firms that haven't done much of this can now start to experience and learn from people like yourself and some of the other speakers. You know, what advice could you give to someone who's never experienced electronic discovery from say, a law firm's perspective?
Don't be afraid. I think that the there's a certain intimidation factor that keeps people looking for short-sighted shortcuts and quick answers instead of digging in to learn it and telling themselves, this is stuff I cannot get. You can get it. You break down what you need to know in e-discovery in small enough manageable bites, and you can learn anything. Lawyers are smart, smart people. So what I would say is get the education you need. The number one critical issue facing e-discovery today is the lack of substantive knowledge of the necessary basic technologies. Not the bits and bytes and atomic level stuff, but just the fundamental lingo and concepts of e-discovery that lawyers continue to avoid. I'll put it to you this way. When you or I were 15 or 16, we devoted many hours to learning a particular skill. We learned to drive. Mm-hmm. We went to school, our parents taught us, we read a book about it, we took tests on it. We devoted a couple of weeks or months or what have you to gaining that skill. And that skill has served us well every day of our lives. And yet, I find most lawyers don't spend even the minimal time it would take to learn to drive to learn to manage electronic evidence, which is going to be the litmus test of their ability to remain in the litigation practice going forward. So give it at least that much effort, and I think you'll be rewarded to find that it's not as hard to understand and to master even as lawyers tend to convince themselves it will be.
Okay, and then corporate clients have a different set of problems because they're dealing with all these records. Any advice to them?
Well, it's a much more complicated situation to distill into a soundbite. I mean, obviously,
maybe do a separate show on it, huh?
Well, I mean, you really could. I mean, I think we could do a whole series of shows on how corporate clients can reduce the cost of e-discovery and make themselves less exposed to it. But the fact of the matter is that, it is not as hard. Get it centralized. Get rid of what you can get rid of. I think everyone understands that. Resist I shouldn't even say resist. Several years ago, Carl, I was in the same bandwagon that everybody else is saying, you know, you got to get rid of more stuff. And in the last 2 years, I've come to the conclusion that what we instead need to be preparing to do is for what is essentially wholesale retention, people not getting rid of much of anything. And I mean, that's what we're going to face. So instead of pretending that somebody is going to implement a data destruction program that isn't going to get them in hot water and that's really going to be, going to work in a complex data environment, I think that's nonsense. I think much as that's devoutly to be wished, it's not likely to happen. So let's prepare for the data environment we're really going to face instead of the one that is just wishful thinking.
All right, now let's talk about computer forensics. What are computer forensics and how does it relate to electronic discovery?
Well, computer forensics is really just a global term for in the context of litigation and the law, managing, collecting, preserving, analyzing the electronic traces of all of the devices and systems that are parts of our lives today. I like to think of computer forensics in a somewhat different way. I think computer forensics is finding the drama in the bits and bytes. It's teasing the human drama, the human story, out of all the little traces that we leave in this very wired world, whether it be where we go on the internet, on our handheld devices, what we touch in terms of files, what doors we open with cards, what we do on television and video screens as we drive around the city, as we move around the world, and the GPS tracks our cell phones and our vehicles, all of this enormous mass of disparate data, all about us, our favorite subjects, and it really tells a story. It really allows a great deal of depth, and it is also the interpretation of metadata, the parts of the data that are not immediately apparent and understandable to the user day-to-day, making sense of that, knowing what's reliable, what's unreliable, being able to bring it back from the dead when some people have made it go away. I think that's really all the world of computer forensics.
It's almost like there should be more TV drama on this side of the story instead of murders, huh?
Well, you know, the blood and gore sells a whole lot more than bits and bytes. And frankly, what I've seen of computer forensics when depicted on shows, particularly CSI, is enough to just make a computer forensicist grind his or her teeth to nubs.
Okay.
It's awful. They sit down at the evidence computer, start typing away, and the next thing you know, they found a video of a person committing a crime. It's utter nonsense, and it's bad forensics.
Okay. Well, when do you need to use a computer forensics as an attorney?
Well, you need to consider computer forensics in every case, and I want to be careful with that. I'm not saying you use computer forensics, but you need to approach every case and ask yourself the question, is this a case where the degree of preservation and the approach I have to take with the electronic evidence demands a forensic level of preservation and a forensic level of examination? Most of the time, your answer is going to be no. The active data, we can preserve that to a sufficient degree without having to worry about all of the forensic niceties. But where you have cases of, for example, data theft, data destruction or spoliation, alteration of data, forgery of electronic documents, use of computers as an instrumentality of fraud or tort or theft, those should be ringing a bell in your head. These are cases where forensic level preservation is important, and forensic examination may be a case-making or case-breaking technology.
Okay. Is there a place that you go look to find a computer forensics vendor? I mean, I saw a couple days ago someone posting on a listserv, does anyone know a good computer forensic examiner? How do you find someone?
Well, that's a good question. I would say that you wouldn't go to the yellow pages any more than you would consider going to the yellow pages for a lawyer to be a good idea. You know, you get good experts. In computer forensics, the same way you get good experts in any other discipline, which means you ask around to colleagues whose judgment you trust, colleagues who have succeeded using the discipline. Who do you use? What do you like about this person? Are they trustworthy? Do they bill in a fair way? Are they timely? How do they hold up in terms of credentials on cross-examination? Then you look at their credentials and you check them. I mean, you call people. Even if you're given references that are good references, I find that you can still tell a lot of bad about somebody by calling their satisfied customers. You'd be surprised what can slip out. You check their credentials. If somebody says that they have a degree and it's key and that they actually have it, you make sure that they're in good standing. You make sure that if they're required to have certain licensure, that they have that licensure. If they're self-taught, then you want to be sure they have an appropriate certification or other ways that they're going to qualify. They're going to meet a Daubert standard or other standards that are local to the court. I mean, you just don't want to hang your hat on a computer forensicist who took a weekend course, bought a tool, and hung out their shingle, because they are going to get you crucified at trial. I am very concerned right now, Carl, about the decreasing caliber of the forensicists that I am seeing in the area of computer forensics. I mean, there's some lousy computer forensics folks out there, and I'm seeing some reports that just blow me away in terms of the callous and rather ignorant way that people go about it, not to mention in some instances computer forensicists can be the data's and the evidence's worst enemy.
So, I mean, are there any certifications, or is this the Wild West? The whole protocol for finding special masters seemed to be basically who do you know, and it seems like this is sort of a similar area.
Yes and no. I mean, I came out of the personal injury trial practice, and in that practice you typically have what are called guardians ad litem, and these are people appointed to resolve any perceived conflict between a parent acting on behalf of an injured minor child and so forth. And there's a lot of cronyism in that area. It was often a former partner of the judge or a drinking buddy or what have you. So I'm familiar with the kind of worry that you're raising. But I think you'll find that with Rule 53 special masters, people who are brought in because they have particular expertise, there's far less abuse that way. And I think judges tend to be pretty careful in their selection of special masters. In fact, many judges are very reluctant to appoint special masters. They do so either when they feel like it's something that demands specialized knowledge, and computer forensics is certainly a good example, as well as complex electronic discovery, or where the amount of work that is going to be needed and the immediacy of response that the parties will need in order to achieve the best and fairest and lowest cost result for the case demands somebody who can give that degree of focus. So I don't see the same abuses on special masters that you're describing. Most of the special masters I know, and there are only a handful of special masters in the e-discovery and computer forensics arena, most of them tend to be pretty conscientious, well-qualified folks.
Okay. Now, in your opinion, are forensics experts things that you can find nationally, or is this more of a local specialty area?
Well, there's really nothing about the practice that suggests an advantage to going locally. I mean, yeah, I suppose there is a small cost savings if you're doing a physical acquisition of the drive to have somebody who doesn't have to take a plane flight or a long drive to get to it. But I think you'll find that when it's feasible to do so, it's a lot less expensive to send the machine or the drive to the forensicist than bring the forensicist to the machine.
Huh.
So it's, I mean, I have a national practice. I would find that relatively few of my clients overall are in Texas. They tend to be in other states with, you know, obviously cities where there's a lot of litigation, complex cases and so forth, where forensics come into play. So I'm as likely to be in California, Chicago, New York, Florida, as I am to be in Texas.
And, you know, when you're looking for a computer forensics expert, what do they really, what can a forensics expert do for you, and what can't they do for you?
That's a really good question, because I think people need to have realistic expectations about just those things, about what can you do with forensics and what can't you do. I mean, forensics won't necessarily be able to tell you whose hands were on the computer at a particular time. Forensics won't be able to recover, in some instances, every bit of deleted data. Forensics isn't going to be able to recover information that has been thoroughly wiped and overwritten. What forensics will be able to do, however, is to help you establish the basis for an adverse inference instruction or a spoliation claim for the wiping of that drive. Forensics will be able to paint something of a second-by-second pattern of usage of a machine to be able to see what information was moved around, what was touched, what applications were employed, and to basically, as I say, translate those electronic footprints into human behavior and hopefully tell a story. I view it as a kind of mind reading in the right cases. You can get an insight to what a party was actually thinking and planning. It's not unusual at all for me to examine a machine and see a pattern such as this. The individual will receive a demand for preservation of their computers or for forensic examination. Many times that will prompt the person to first do a little legal research, see what all the big words are about, and then you see the research change. As I analyze their internet usage and what files they download and touch, I start to see them investigating how to make data go away. What tracks do they leave behind? I may see them purchase a data wiping or destruction application and then use it. So I really can see the gears turning in their mind like a rat in a trap. How do I get out of this? And then, frankly, a person who destroys evidence is my best friend from this standpoint. Most people do it so badly that it's as though they took a yellow highlighter to a voluminous document and just highlighted all the things that they were most afraid of me finding. So, you know, I don't advocate people destroying evidence, especially from this standpoint, Carl, which is nothing I have ever found destroyed on a computer was as bad as the impression that was left by the effort to make it go away. The hole left behind by data destruction is much worse than whatever once filled it.
Okay. One of the areas that I've written a bit about is the collaboration issue in e-discovery, and it's not between parties or between the other side. It's within your team. And you know, one of the things I've seen in broad e-discovery is you've got people that host your data, that help you set up the software, the lawyer, maybe staffing people, and they're all sort of independently working in their specialty area. And that can create problems of communication. Is forensics an area where you independently hand off, or is it an area where the lawyer and the forensic examiner are you know, there's a supervisory role or a collaborative role?
Well, I think there should be something of a collaborative role. It's not that I necessarily expect the lawyer to be looking over my shoulder as I'm examining the data. But I need to know a lot about, I mean, there's a great amount of information on almost any drive today, and I rarely just look at one drive. I'm usually looking at quite a number of drives, maybe a whole department or three or four or five machines and that were used by an individual and all their thumb drives and CDs and external hard drives. The volumes routinely get into the terabytes now. With that in mind, I need the lawyer to help me understand what the case is about. My being a lawyer has proven to be a huge advantage. I feel I can get up to speed pretty quickly about what it is they need,
sometimes even advise them if they're interested in what I think I can find that will assist them before they've even thought about it. But that's a collaborative role. I need to know what they're trying to accomplish. I often ask a client, look, do you want the evidence or do you want the sanction? Because while my methodology will be the same, I want to know what you're looking for. Am I really trying to my darndest to get this information back in e-discovery or using forensics? Or is what this is really about is that you want a sanction? I don't tend to like to work as much in the secondary. I want people who want the evidence as my clients. But that said,
I
need a timeline from the lawyers. I need the dates. I need issues. I need names, keywords. I'm going to need that collaborative process from the lawyer to help me streamline and what I'm doing and know what I'm looking for. Because unless they have an unlimited budget, I can't just say to them, well, okay, give me the computer and I'll find everything that might be relevant, because nobody can afford that or nobody should want that. So, yeah, we work together. I report back what I'm finding. I get direction. I advise the lawyer when I think further work is kind of a dead end. I advise them where I think that we're plowing some fertile ground and I need to really dig in and have all my I's dotted and my T's crossed to be ready to testify about it. And I talk to them about what they're looking for in the way of the form of a report. And I get a lot of feedback from lawyers. I think the one thing that lawyers need to do and have no hesitation is ask me to explain things. I don't care if you have me explain it 10 times. As long as the lawyer wants to learn it and is interested, I'm thrilled to talk about these things. But I think lawyers need to get over the idea that they've got to be the smartest person in the room in every setting. Let's close the door. Acknowledge to me you don't know what the heck you're doing in this area. I'll be quiet about it. And now let's each get each other up to speed so that we're both comfortable helping each other achieve the best result for the client.
Actually, that was one of Judge Shindlin's really good points on last week's podcast is either do it right or speak up. Don't be stuck in the middle and get hammered by sort of, fumbling your way through it.
Well, the problem, of course, is fumbling your way through it has worked so well for so many years that people aren't ready to find that it's not working very well anymore.
Well, in terms of collaboration, I guess one of the areas where you'd be working with the lawyers, how do you, and the client, because they're paying for this, is how do you pick what to examine?
Oh, it depends upon what the case is about, but it's not that hard. I mean, if the case involves the behavior of particular individuals, you look at what they did and what tools they used. Were they laptop people on the road? Were they desktop people? Did they work through an intermediary like a proxy, like an assistant or someone, particularly older users tend to have a tendency to rely upon proxies for their work. Are they BlackBerry people? Are they very wired? Do they work at home a lot? Do they use Gmail versus an Exchange server? Once you begin to learn what they know and how they do business, the media just kind of jumps out at you. If you know what you're doing, you're going to know where to look for this stuff. And, of course, looking at one piece of media almost invariably points to other media. When I look at a laptop, I'm going to be able to see what other media or systems has this laptop connected to, and I can begin to identify a path that I want to go down to track certain data, because when, say, data is stolen, it may come out of the former employer on an external hard drive or a thumb drive, maybe emailed out. It's got to go in somewhere. So then I'm going to be looking for machines at the new employer, at home or elsewhere, where that media came in, and then I'm going to be following that trail as far as it leads or as far as the budget allows.
How do you gather forensic information without ordering a party to stop using its systems? I mean, isn't this fairly intrusive?
It doesn't have to be. It depends upon what it is you're trying to achieve. Forensic analysis of a server, which tends to be the most mission critical part of a system, the thing that they least want to shut down, is often a fruitless effort. I mean, servers are optimized in a way that you tend not to get much from the unallocated clusters, from looking in the areas where deleted data would reside. So there, you don't have to necessarily shut down. You may be able to do an active acquisition while the machine is still doing its job and get the information you need. If it's a laptop that somebody depends on or a desktop, well, you know, you get them to do something else for a few hours while you image it. You do it overnight. It's not terribly unusual for me to do what's called the black bag acquisition, where you come in after business hours and, you know, you grab the data that's owned by the employer and you analyze it, and the employee may be none the wiser that their machine was examined. So
yeah, those are all fun.
Do it without being unduly disruptive if the parties are willing to work together reasonably, and this is most important, Carl, and you can assure yourself that the delay is not being used to reinvent history, delete data, or change data.
Sometimes when you talk to a techie or technologist that maintains a system, they'll talk about getting a ghost image. Is that the sort of thing that works within the field of forensics for eDiscover, or do you got to do more than that?
Ghost has many strengths and many weaknesses, but it is not essentially a forensically sound collection tool. And the reason for that is that, though it is feasible, if you run Ghost under DOS, which means it's going to run very slowly, you can use command line instructions that are somewhat obscure to actually obtain the unallocated clusters and slack space of a drive. So you can get a forensically sound image. You have to turn off Ghost's propensity to alter the drive, to basically mark the drive with its own signature. So if you know what you're doing, you can use it. Unfortunately, almost nobody knows what they're doing, and the image that they get using Ghost is not an image in the sense that forensicists use it, where it's a file or series of files that hold the information and are often self-authenticating, but it is really a clone. And use of a clone presents a lot of issues in forensics. As soon as you connect that clone to another Windows machine, if it's not write protected using special hardware or software, that data is going to be marred in some fashion. So I always advise against using Ghost for forensic collection. It simply is not efficient, it's not that cost effective, and it does a terrible job. In fact, Ghost, used normally, is an anti-forensic tool. It not only changes the data, but it strips away the unallocated clusters and the slack space, so what you get is substantially less usable as a forensic image, or as a source of forensic examination. I hate to give this little tidbit away, but I'll tell you, the truth of the matter is, I get a lot more of value doing a forensic examination of active data than I do of unallocated clusters most of the time. There's so much active data that's so revealing, even when people have tried to make a lot of it go away, that you really can get a lot of great stuff, even if you don't have the unallocated clusters. But if you're going to do a competent forensic examination, you've got to have all three. You've got to have the slack space, the active data, and the unallocated clusters. And Ghost is typically not going to give you that.
Okay. One of my favorite cases or quotes in the case is the Facciola quote in the McPeak case, where he criticizes lawyers for asking for what they want. If they ask for what they think they want, they might get what they need. And I'm thinking about the difference between a forensically sound acquisition and a forensic examination. I mean, you've talked at times about the difference between the two, and you know, what's your advice in this area?
Well, a forensically sound acquisition and a forensic examination are as different as saying take a cheek swab and do a DNA test, because one is grabbing the evidence in a way that makes your examination reliable, and the other is how to look at it using tools and techniques that allow you to divine what that information has to tell you. I'm not sure if that's the distinction you were seeking, but I do think this. I find the word forensically sound is abused. Forensically sound, in my judgment, should be reserved solely to the collection in a bitstream manner of all of the bits and bytes sequentially from a piece of media in a way that it can be authenticated against that media, that you can get a hash match a digital fingerprint that proves that the copy that you've made is a complete and unaltered duplicate of the original evidence. Anything less than that, I think you abuse the word forensically sound.
Okay, and what I was going at more was, you know, getting more intrusive than you have to, you know, asking for the world. You know, I'm not sure if you see that happen, you know, in heavy-duty litigation where people just go crazy with forensically sound acquisition requests.
I do. I find that, you know, the old expression that if the only tool you have is a hammer, all the world looks like a nail. Well, I find some of that with people who have used forensics and really gotten a great result as a consequence of it in a case where it made sense. And then kind of all of a sudden they want to use the forensic approach to everything. That's not cost effective and it's not warranted. You know, as we talked about earlier, forensics has its place in certain kinds of cases. And in those cases, it's essential. It's a case-making, case-breaking technology. But if there is such a thing as a run-of-the-mill e-discovery case where, you know, the data hasn't been corrupted, the data hasn't been deleted, they're hidden, et cetera, then probably forensics is massive overkill. So I think that you have an abuse problem there of people demanding a forensic level of preservation far beyond where that should matter to them. They should, as we said at the very start of this call, they should anticipate forensics in every case. They should consider, is this a custodian whose conduct is so critical to this case that we can't even afford the risk of a charge of spoliation or non-preservation? And maybe we'll make a decision as an insurance policy of sorts, we'll do a forensic level preservation for this person. Because if they have messed up and they have gotten rid of something, I mean, like the CEO, for example, we want the ability to mitigate that immediately and be able to say to the court, judge, it is no problem. We have a forensic level preservation. We've set it aside. We can fix that. I think the other issue is metadata. It's become something of a buzzword. It's an area in which I have a tremendous amount of interest. I've written about it ad nauseum, and I think people still continue not to get an understanding of metadata. Metadata is just data about data. It's all of the indices, all of the logs and the information about the system metadata like modified access, created dates. The name of a file is metadata. Most files don't know their own name. The location of a file, the custodian of a file, these are all things outside of the data, but which bear significantly on understanding the data and making sense of the data. And I hear people say, well, I want you to produce all the metadata. And they don't even know what they're talking about. Do they mean application metadata? Do they mean system metadata? There are hundreds and hundreds of metadata fields that may potentially exist with regard to certain kinds of files. Do they even know what they're asking for, and would they know what to do with that car once they chase it and catch it?
Well, you know, I'm going to try to rein the topic in here at the end into a couple of key points. But what would you say, you know, and we've covered a lot of ground here, that the most challenging issues are facing computer forensics field? Now that you're warmed up.
Well, that's easy. I mean, I think there are really a couple. One of them, above all, is volume. I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, it would have been rare for me to see anything larger than an 80-gigabyte hard drive for analysis in a business setting. Today, it is not unusual for me to see 500 gigabytes and up. You can now buy a terabyte hard drive for $100. We're going to see terabyte drives becoming pretty much standard issue in new desktop purchases, and in no time, we're going to see 500 gigs and up be the standard for even your cheap laptops. Well, you know, with active data, you can just look to how the parts of that are used. So if somebody buys a terabyte drive, maybe they've got, if they've been busy with it, 100 gigabytes on. But with forensics, you've got to acquire the entire terabyte because you've got to get the unallocated clusters too. And that means that hours go into the acquisition, and in order to search that information and process that information, the software tools have to work their magic over a much bigger canvas. And that means that forensics becomes more expensive without necessarily delivering a lot more information. The other challenge we face is going to be the proliferation of on-disk encryption, automatic encryption that's built into hard disks, that's built into devices, because hard encryption is essentially unbreakable for all intents and purposes. And so as, particularly in the criminal arena, as we see hard drives automatically encrypting the data, we're going to see people getting away with more because we won't be able to look at their information.
What would you say are the biggest mistakes being made in forensics today?
There are a lot.
And you may have already covered it.
Well, no, I wouldn't. I haven't. I really have barely scratched the surface. I think there are several. One of that comes to mind is people jumping to conclusions. You know, it's so easy to want to be the hero when you're the computer forensic examiner. It's so overwhelmingly strong, the desire to find the smoking gun, to effectuate the intent of what your clients want. And so even in good faith with good intentions, it's very easy to look at a set of facts, to look at a set of last access dates on files and go, aha, we've caught the person. You know, the blackguard has been nailed. When really a more dispassionate, a more careful look at the information in context will often reveal that what you think the information means isn't what it really means. So I think jumping to conclusions, poor training, the sense of push-button forensics that you can buy a tool and hit the find evidence button, and all of a sudden, even though you don't really know how it's going about it, that it's going to roll off with all this stuff that's going to make you look good in your report. Let me tell you something. There is no tool that can do that. Forensics is as much an art as a science. It's about understanding what you see, understanding what it means, and making sense of that information. And that's not how I'm seeing a lot of computer forensicists go about it. They are looking at a few places that in a book they were told to look. They are interpreting things in whatever way it occurs to them, and then they are writing reports that just seem to satisfy the client. And I think we're seeing some abuses in that regard. I'm talking in the civil arena right now. I'm not really talking about the criminal arena as much. And I wrote recently about some abuse of computer forensics issues in a blog post that I did on the EDD Update blog, which I hope people will have a chance to take a look at. It's okay. EDDupdate.com.
All right, I have one last question, but then I have a couple questions from the audience, actually, which aren't bad. Where can a listener look to learn more about forensics? Where would you suggest? You mentioned the blog post that you just contributed, but where else?
Oh, there is a great site, and I think it's called eevidenceinfo.com. Hold on just a second. I have it linked, and so I need to find it. But it's the eEvidence Information Center, and it is e-evidence.info. So www.e-evidence.info.
Okay.
And this is, I believe it's a professor up in New York State, I think, who just maintains a wonderful links list. And Christine's list is where I go when I want to see what people are writing. You can go to this site and you can find ways to get trained, what universities are offering training. You can find virtually everything that's ever been published on forensics that's available by the web. And it's just a wonderful feast of information. So if somebody really wants to dig in, this is a great place to start.
Now, this might be a scary question given what you said of some of the loose forensics being practiced, but one question was, what software tools are out there for computer forensics and how much of it's available to people who are not governmental organizations or security professionals?
Well, most of it is available out there. I mean, very little of the tools are reserved exclusively to law enforcement. In fact, it used to be there was a tool called iLook that was only available to law enforcement, but even of late, that's become a commercial tool. The leading tools in computer forensics, the leading suites, and by the way, you don't just use one tool. There is no Swiss Army knife, no matter how people might want to market it, that of the one thing that does everything the best. Of course, the best known tool is Guidance Software's EnCase. Another tool is Access Data's forensic toolkit. Technology Pathways has a tool for investigation. And my particular favorite, the one that I use more often than any other, is a tool by a company called X-Ways, X-W-A-Y-S Forensics. And I find their forensic tool is something that is I turn to first. It seems to do what all the others do just about as well, but it costs less. But as I say, you don't use just one tool. And if a good forensicist cross-checks their key findings using different tools. And you also use tools that are best suited for the application. It may be that to process email, the tools I've mentioned are not your best choice. It may be you'll use a command line tool. It may be you'll use a little tool that you've developed in-house or a script that you've written yourself. The goal is to have a utility belt of tools, a toolkit that you can use so that you can have confidence in what you're finding. And I learned forensics using a hex editor, Norton Disk Editor, and to me, I'm still old-fashioned. I believe you got to learn to do it down on the media before you start buying any highfalutin expensive tools to make your job easier.
How dangerous would you say it is to use Gmail?
I don't find Gmail dangerous at all. I mean, I think Gmail is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I think your security exposure is minimal in Gmail, and I don't find it to be any greater in exposure than any other web-accessible resource. I mean, if you think about it, most people who run their own Exchange servers also support some level of webmail, and so anybody who has login credentials can get in. I mean, if you have a user ID and a password, or you haven't protected your password very well, you're getting in almost anything.
Hmm.
And I don't see Gmail as being significantly more vulnerable to that. In fact, I think Gmail, it's got so much better a spam filter that I think it does a better job at email than most of the Exchange server and Outlook installations I see.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I got rid of my email infrastructure and server and so forth, and I've completely virtualized that.
You're in the cloud.
Using Google Apps.
That's good. I'm a big fan of cloud tools as well,
exactly.
As we're working right now in the cloud.
And, of course, the cloud is an emerging challenge to electronic discovery, as are all the empowerment and growth of sophistication of the handheld devices. I mean, we're seeing people moving off to essentially doing most of their work on iPhone and related platforms, and that creates new challenges to forensics because all of these devices tend to be very proprietary. And, Carl, do you mind if I add one more to
sure.
Where do you go for information about forensics?
It's mm-hmm.
immodest, but I've spent a lot of time writing about forensics and writing particularly for a lawyer audience who is uncomfortable with technology and hopefully making it accessible. So I hope people will stop by my website where there are a number of free papers.
Absolutely.
And that site is Craig Ball, CraigBall.com.
And we'll link to that as well once the site's up, and that'll be on the www.esibytes.com website. Well, this has been very informative, Craig. I appreciate your spending some time delving in this area. We probably went a little long, but it doesn't matter because this is such a an area that I think people are very interested in, and appreciate you spending the time.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for including me in your interviewees list.
This has been another edition of the ESI Bytes show, where you can find more shows listed at www.esibytes.com. So don't get bit by e-discovery. Get involved. Learn about it. That's basically it. Thanks again.